Before the Great Depression, there was the farm recession. Following World War I, times were tough for farm families in Iowa. This hour, we'll focus on the lives of rural Iowa women in the 1920s. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vitra Covert was born in rural Davis County in 1916. She died in 1990. Her grandson, Chris Baker, has just published a journal that she left behind in the new book, Others Had It Worse, Sour Dock, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. We'll talk about her life, and historians Dorothy Schweder and Catherine Jellison will be here to help us understand the times. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Times were tough when Vitra Covert was growing up in rural Davis County. She was born in 1916. She didn't talk much about her childhood, but thanks to a college assignment, her grandson helped her preserve some of her memories. Chris Baker has just published his grandmother's journal in the book Others Had It Worse, Sour Dock, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. In a few minutes, I'll talk with historians Dorothy Schweder and Catherine Jellison about what life was like for rural women in the 1920s. But first, we're going to focus on Vitra. And Chris Baker is here with me now. Thank you so much for being here, Chris.
Hi, Charity. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your relationship with your grandma growing up.
Well, the relationship was, in a way, somewhat distant because, I knew her when she was in her 50s and 60s. And I always viewed her as this stoic person who was always in the kitchen, working at the stove, cooking, baking, and a kind of a quiet person, reserved. And actually, I can't speak for the rest of my family or my cousins and siblings, but I always found her a little intimidating.
So when you were in college and you got this assignment in your journalism class to interview somebody in your family, what made you think, well, I'll talk to Grandma?
Well, I think I was a little bit older at that time. I was 19. Seems like a long time ago. And like you said, I was here at the University of Iowa studying journalism. And, I'd grown a little bit closer to her again, began to, as I get older, value those relationships. So I chose her and drove back to Ottumwa to do the interview.
Did you have an idea when you decided to interview her that her upbringing was pretty remarkable, that she had a lot of stories to tell?
Well, prior to the interview, really, I had no idea of exactly the kind of life that she did experience as a child. I certainly knew that they lived in a rural area, and that was kind of foreign to me because I pretty much grew up as a city kid. And so I found that intriguing. When I started to do the interviews, I really was surprised, by the kind of, difficult life that she did experience.
And you also left her with a journal, but not even really a journal, a legal tablet.
Right. Notebook I used to take notes during the interview, when I was done, just on a whim, I guess, I tore my notes out, stuck them in my pocket, and said, here, Grandma, why don't you write some things down? And, frankly, I really didn't think much about it after that, and till that notebook came back to me several years later in 1990 after she had
when
passed
she
away.
Died. Yeah. So you didn't even know that she had done it.
No, I did not. I did not. I did remember giving her the notebook, but I was surprised. Fortunately, my mother and her siblings, when going through her things, found the notebook, and then it was returned to me.
And she wrote about 30 handwritten pages.
Right.
About her childhood.
Right. And it was very interesting. She didn't really have a narrative per se, and more of random memories. So that was quite a task to wade through that, and also later trying to decide how to present that material.
Right. Do you remember your reaction when you first got your hands back on that legal tablet back in 1990?
Well, I read it, of course, and was quite intrigued, and because so many of these stories, I really had no idea when I interviewed her at age 19, I remember the story about Spot the Cow, which we were going to talk about
right,
later.
Right, we'll get to that in a little while.
And, of course, you know, I focused in on that immediately as a young journalism student. Some of the depth of the stories and talking about the poverty and, you know, they were both intriguing and upsetting.
Right.
You
know? Well, let's dig into this a little bit and talk about her history. And you also, in the introduction to the book, you flesh out the family history a little bit because, of course, in her journal, she's only telling it from her perspective. And a woman with maybe a seventh grade education who was quite elderly when she wrote these down.
Right.
You know, it's not exactly a full picture of everything.
No, and it's interesting. I would love to be able to go back and interview her again and ask her, why did you pick this particular period in your life? Because her writing basically covers from 1920 to 1929, age 4 to 13. And I think that's very interesting, you know, why she focused on that specifically.
That is really interesting. And it's a very difficult time for farmers in Iowa. This is during the farm recession that preceded the Great Depression, although I'm guessing times just got harder for her family as time went on.
Absolutely. You know, there were a lot of historical events at play at this time. And certainly the Great Depression is looming and Prohibition has begun. They were living in very rural Iowa really didn't have the means. They had actually lived in a log cabin at the time that they bought elsewhere and tore it down and brought it back to some property they had inherited. And if you think about it, even back then in the 20s, I mean, not a lot of people were living in log cabins. So I think that speaks to the level of the poverty they
right.
were experiencing.
And they weren't a typical farm family.
No, not
Your
at all.
Your great-grandfather was not a typical farmer.
No, not by any stretch. And one of my second cousins states in the book that his grandfather, you know, measured his corn yield in gallons, not bushels.
All right,
he was a moonshiner.
Right. All right, so that was the household that your grandmother grew up in, a log cabin. Her dad was making moonshine, and this is, of course, leading up to Prohibition. So this is a very difficult profession.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that really struck me about it in her writing was that, you know, she really discusses the impact that had on the family. She obviously was not happy about it. From everything I've heard gleaned through interviews with family members, my great-grandmother, Edith, was not very happy about it either. But there we are.
And your great-grandfather, he was a moonshiner. He also had friends that would come around the cabin that would drink themselves into stupors. Your grandmother writes about that.
Right. And, you know, you can just imagine as a young child, that kind of environment be very difficult, very difficult.
Well, and she even describes one man who would come, he would pass out on the floor and just lay on the floor.
Right. And, you know, you think about moonshine, too. That can be very toxic. beverage, to say the least, and, you know, when they're drinking at that kind of a level. It's pretty devastating.
The stories that a lot of your family members have passed down about your great-grandfather, mm-hmm. and his name was Wilmer.
Right.
A lot of those stories tend to be humorous, painting him sort of in the life of a rapscallion.
Right.
You know, why don't you tell the story about his fishing license? I think that really is emblematic.
Well, sure. And those are the kind of stories I always heard growing up and going to family reunions. And he was sort of this, you know, character that everyone in the family talked about. And one incident that was retold that he had actually been down fishing on Shaquess Creek near where they lived. And local law enforcement came by, noticed him fishing, and I'm sure they knew exactly.
Right, he was on their radar.
Yeah. So he was approached, and the officer said, need to see your fishing license. And Wilmer evidently told him, well, I don't have it. I can't find it. Sorry. And so the officer was going to take him to jail for that. So he loaded up his gear, got in the car, and they drove down the road a bit. And at that point, suddenly Wilmer said, oh, wait a minute, I just remember where it's at. And the officer said, where? And he goes, well, it's in my hat band. And so the officer stopped the car. Wilmer retrieved the license from his band, and it was legal, handed it to him, and started to get out of the car. Well, as Wilmer had timed it, as the story goes, the officer had stopped right in front of his house.
So he got a ride home.
Got a free ride home, yes.
Now, stories like that, of course, don't shed light on how your grandmother felt about her father.
Right.
She describes him as a very hard man in whatever kind of description she gives. In fact, could you read a little bit from the book about sleepwalking? Because your grandmother was a sleepwalker, which was a very dangerous thing.
Sure.
At that time, in that place.
Sure, I'd love to. This chapter is called Sleepwalking. I always walked in my sleep. Not because I wanted to, I just couldn't help it. I never got hurt, but I would get up in my sleep and walk around the stairway. It was an open one and no railing. Reeve decided she would sleep in front. If I got out of bed, she would catch me. But one night, I got out of bed in the winter and took all the covers off her and made it to the stairway before she caught me. One night, I was just stepping off the bottom step when I woke up. Boy, I made a fast trip back to bed. I wouldn't be down there because everyone was sleeping upstairs.
And continuing on to the next section as well.
Sure. And this is titled, If She's Gone, She's Gone, and it kind of speaks to my great-grandfather. My grandmother writes, one nighttime we had company. We kids lay on the floor and went to sleep. When the company was gone, Mom and Barbara was getting us to bed. I was missing. Boy, I guess everyone was going crazy looking and hollering for me. Dad said, well, if she's gone, she's gone. But finally, someone found me curled up in a tire flower bed asleep. I wouldn't have been there for nothing, I tell you.
But her dad said, if she's gone, she's gone.
Yeah, interesting comment.
Right. And she, in many comments that she makes in her manuscript, she writes, ha ha, if something's a joke. She didn't write ha ha there.
She did not write ha ha there. Absolutely not. And so from talking to relatives and recounting that event, some people were not surprised.
We're gonna take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Chris Baker, who is the author, along with his great-grandmother, Vitra Melrose Paget Covert, of the book Others Had It Worse, Sour Dock, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. He'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Chris Baker. He has just published a new book called Others Had It Worse, Sour Dock, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa specifically. And the book includes the journal of his great-grandmother, Vitra Melrose Paget Covert. She was born in 1916 in rural Davis County. When she died in 1990, she left behind about 30 handwritten pages of a journal remembering her childhood. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll bring a few historians into the conversation to talk about what life was like, particularly for women in rural Iowa in the 1920s. And we were talking specifically before the break about the very difficult relationship that your grandmother had with her father. And this, her distaste for her father lasted for her entire life. I mean, she wrote some very telling things about her relationship with her father. And you describe, when you're writing about the family history, a time when before he died, where he tried to actually give her a hug, and she said, you've got to be kidding.
Right. You know, and it's a very complicated relationship. I mean, I certainly know that she still looked after him, took care of him, and had contact with him. But certainly, you know, she harbored some resentment about her childhood. Absolutely.
There were also some really fun memories that she shared in her journal. And why don't we share a couple of those? Maybe this one's not so fun, but it does speak to what life was like on the farm. Tell us about the snake in the hen house.
Oh, sure. My grandmother writes, we had several hens for us, and one time we kept finding eggs sucked in the nest. Couldn't find out what was doing it. Finally, Mom found a snake. It had swallowed a whole egg and crawled through a hole, and there swallowed another, and there he was. She sure made fast work of him.
And the next story as well. We finally caught him.
Right. We finally caught him. Absolutely. We finally got a few cows. When we drove them through the hog lot, we had a pig that would suck one cow dry. We didn't know what was doing it till we finally caught him sitting up, sucking away.
So they had a cow they just couldn't get milk from.
Right.
And then a pig was taking care of all of that.
Right.
Milk. I've never heard of anything like that.
Nor have I.
Actually, let's go on and read us Sea Spot Drunk also.
Yes, this is related to my great-grandfather's moonshining activities. I went to get our cow Spot one night. We only had one cow, and she wore a bell around her neck so we could find her. I was going along singing and calling her. Finally, I thought I heard her bell and walked down that way and saw her standing spraddle-legged with the bell hanging over one ear. I went down and hit her on the rump to start her to the barn. She staggered and run her head in the ground and bawled. It scared me. I run to the house to get Mom. She come back with me. She looked at her and said, "She's drunk." She found the barrel of mash was half gone. Spot sure was drunk. We finally got her to the barn. Her milk wasn't good for a while, but when she had her calf, it was a nice big one, but it couldn't get up or stand up for a long time. Barbara done the milking. She would have to hold the calf up while it sucked the cow.
The incredible poverty of the family really comes through in a lot of your grandmother's memories. And one of the things that she writes about is going out and collecting greens.
Right.
So that the family was living largely, it sounded like at times, off of dandelion greens and other things that she and her brothers and sisters could forage.
Right. Sourdough. Dandelions. She describes some kind of a thistle. She mentions doing it quite often, sometimes, you know, twice a day. So certainly that does speak to the level of their situation, how they were struggling to get by.
There's also another entry that I would love for you to read about Christmas Day that I think really speaks to some of the very difficult times that they had.
Absolutely. This was hard for me to read the first time. The other kids always got a lot of gifts that Santa Claus brought. We got a pair of stockings. One time, Mom sold her geese she raised and got us new sock caps in our sock. One bag of candy for all. We couldn't understand why all the kids got so much under their tree. One year, we kids cut a small tree and put it up. Decorated it with chains of paper we cut and pasted together. We thought we had it made, but we never got a bit more. We thought Santa didn't like us.
How did your idea of who your grandmother was change from reading this journal?
Oh, it changed incredibly. I mean, certainly a whole newfound respect for her. Just based on what I know now about the struggles that she experienced, as well as her family growing up. It was a hard knock life. And to know that they did manage to get by. And, you know, things were difficult. You know, things were not always the best. There were, you know, I'm sure a lot of scars. She certainly talks about some of the emotional fallout. But they did survive. And that says a lot, too.
You write that your original idea was to type this up as a gift for your mother. Is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is. Yes.
What does she think of this?
Likes it. It's interesting to have her sit down and read through it. And she's made a lot of comments. Some of the stories she didn't even know about. and some she certainly remembers from her childhood or her mother telling her those stories. So, yeah, it did start off as a really a family project, and I hustled my brother and sister into actually going to self-publish, you know, maybe 10 or 15 copies for the family. And after I put the manuscript together and did some writing on a whim, I submitted it to University of Iowa Press, and Holly Carver kind of took it from there and certainly gave me some valuable input, and we expanded some areas and ended up with the final product. So we were all quite surprised.
Right. So you thought that this would be for the family, but it's going far beyond the family. What kind of reaction have you gotten from people who have read it?
Well, good reaction. Really, the people who have read are people close to me.
Right.
So
this month is the publication month.
Right.
So.
Right. So, yeah, I am curious. You know, sometimes you don't know if a personal story like this is going to be if other people are going to be receptive to it,
right.
You know, whether it's too much of a confined story. But apparently there seems to be some interest, so that's pleasing.
Well, we're going to broaden the conversation out now a little bit. And if this story resonates with you, if you have these kind of stories in your family history, you can give us a call and share at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Chris Baker. He's the author of Others Had It Worse, Sour Dock, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. And he will be reading from the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And now we're going to bring Dorothy Schweder into the conversation. She is University Professor Emerita of History at Iowa State University and the author of many books. Hello, Dorothy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Well, you're welcome.
I also want to bring Catherine Jellison into the conversation. She's a professor of history at Ohio University and author of Entitled to Power, Farm Women and Technology, 1913 through 1963. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, folks, and a special hi to Dorothy.
Yes. Hi, Kathy.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Dorothy, why don't we start with you? Take us back to this time, post-World War I, on farms in Iowa, because during the war, the business of agriculture had been good, right?
Yes. There are many different ways that one can look at this. I think it's really important to start with World War I in terms of economic conditions. Iowa farmers did very well in World War I. The government provided price supports. Excuse me. The production was good. Many farmers expanded. expanded their holdings. They bought land on credit. Well, the good times didn't last too long. A couple of years later, the price supports were withdrawn. Farm prices went down to about half of what they had been. And the farmers were still, of course, responsible for paying off the loans. So the 1920s, economically, was really a difficult time for farm families in Iowa. Something like 450 banks went under during the 1920s. In a social vein, I think the thing that sticks out for me is the social isolation. Now, certainly farm families went to town. Farm families neighbored with other farm families. Extension was just getting going in the Iowa countryside, and that would play an important part. But still, when you compared it to town society, farm families were isolated. They were work units. They were social units, many ways unto themselves. Labor-intensive lifestyle. Everybody worked very hard. Men worked hard. Women worked hard. It was still a time that you had very strong ethnic concentrations within the state. Many communities were still identified, German-American, Norwegian-American. So it was a time that Iowa in general was very, very well suited for agriculture, and that was going to carry people through. But it was still a difficult time in specific ways, and rural life was still pretty isolated.
With the economic success of farmers during World War I, had that changed life on the farm in ways that made it hard to go back to subsistence farming and really just getting by?
No, I don't think there were that many changes. There was prosperity, but I don't think really, you mentioned the word subsistence, I don't think that was really an issue. But it imposed economic difficulties. Life in the 1920s, RFD, Rural Free Delivery, had come in before the turn of the century. That was extremely important to farm families, that mail delivery arrived 6 days a week. There was also the telephone. Many farm families had telephones, were getting telephones in the 1920s. And the telephone was really very interesting. If a man talked on the telephone, it was business. If the woman talked on the telephone, it was probably just social, and it was gossip and so forth. They didn't really realize for women how important that was to be able to pick up the phone, talk to a neighbor on a neighboring farm, talk to a relative in town. It was just a very important social connection that women gained from the telephone. But one thing that would not come in the 1920s, this wouldn't come until 1935, was rural electrification. Probably of all things, of all changes, that would change the homemaking duties of farm women almost more than anything else. And of course, that would not come till later.
We'll continue digging into the role of women during this time in a moment. I want to get to the phone. Slayton is on the line in Mount Vernon. Hi, Slayton.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
When I heard him talking earlier about having the book being published, my great aunt in the 1900s or so was when she was a child. She wrote a book in the 70s, or a manuscript, called Where the Cotton Grows Tall, about my family in Oklahoma. And unfortunately, that has since been lost in my family, and no one knows where it's at. And when I was a 17-year-old boy reading this, I remember the stories of her telling about my great-grandfather, who was a subsistence farmer in Oklahoma, and actually selling his cabbage crop 2 and 3 times before it came to fruition. And then losing it, shockingly. and it just sort of surprised me to find out that my great-grandfather was a con artist through reading that. So sometimes these stories aren't necessarily always happy about your family, but to lose them in some sense is even worse. But
absolutely. Slayton, thank you so much for calling and sharing.
Thank you.
And Chris, that is interesting. You know, a lot of us, when we look back in history, we want to be proud of our ancestors, and we don't always find things to be proud of.
Well, certainly that's always a possibility, and I really don't look at it in a sense I'm trying to make any kind of a judgment, but am trying to present the story in whole in as fair a way as possible. So sure, not everything is going to be rosy.
Right. Well, let's get back to the role that women played on the farm. And Catherine, why don't you jump in here? Because we do talk about work on the farm, life on the farm, and the work that women had to do on the farm was just as intense and all-consuming as the work that men had to do on the farm.
Yes, it was. And oftentimes, the women themselves, rhetorically, didn't recognize what they were doing as work. They would talk about helping out on the farm. Because in the 1920s, the term farmer was definitely gendered male. And so oftentimes the work that women and children were doing on Iowa farms wasn't recognized rhetorically. Oh, the kids are helping, mom's helping. But they oftentimes were working in the fields, and even and the milk barns, the poultry house, of course. But even the work that women were doing within the farmhouse was labor intensive. If there was hired labor, the farm woman had to care for the hired hands, provide them with meals, wash their clothing. And as Dorothy mentioned previously, until 1935, there was no reliable highline electricity out in the Iowa countryside. So we're talking about doing so much of the household work and care for family members and hired help with woman power instead of electric power. We had many women also involved in processing agricultural products within their own home, you know, making butter. Oftentimes, women were quite typically the folks who worked in the hen houses, gathered the eggs, took care of the poultry, and as well as preparing those products for their own family, marketing those products.
We're going to take a short break. Catherine, we'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation. Catherine Jellison is a professor of history at Ohio University. Dorothy Schweder is here with us, university professor emerita of history at Iowa State University. And Chris Baker, author of Others Had It Worse, Sourdough, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. We'll be back to this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the lives of rural women in Iowa in the 1920s. This was during the farm recession that led up to the Great Depression. It was a very difficult time. It was before electricity came to rural Iowa. And I'm talking right now with Chris Baker. He is the author of Others Had It Worse, Sourdough, Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa, based on the journal of his grandmother. And also with me, Dorothy Schweder, University Professor Emerita of History at Iowa State University, and Catherine Jellison, Professor of History at Ohio University. And Catherine, before the break, we were talking about the work that women did on the farm. And one of the important things that women had to do, of course, was to keep their families healthy. And they were taking terrific health risks themselves because, of course, many of them were giving birth to many, many children and working extremely hard. What kind of medical resources and medical technology did these women have access to?
Well, as Dorothy had said earlier, of course, the farm family provided most, if not all, of the labor on the farm. And so women were encouraged to have numerous children because the kids were providing much of the labor on the farm. Typically, women living in the countryside at this time still gave birth at home. They might have the physician come to the home where they gave birth, or it might be a midwife situation. By the 1920s, in Iowa, there were certainly doctors in rural areas who typically would be at the bedside when a woman gave birth, but it was not the kind of situation that we know today. And oftentimes, if it was a difficult birth and not being in a hospital environment, the results could be tragic. And we oftentimes don't think about the issue of infant and maternal mortality in the 20th century. We say, oh, you know, in the colonial era, in the 19th century. But in many parts of both rural America and inner city America, as late as the 1920s, childbirth could still be a very daunting event. And this is, of course, also before the development of antibiotics. So infection in childbirth could be a real problem. And infections of any type during this period, including from wounds that occurred out doing the farm work. We don't realize how antibiotics have revolutionized American life and American life in the countryside in the decades since World War II.
Right. Well, and I interviewed a man not that long ago. We talked about his family history, and his great-grandmother lost I believe it was 6 children to scarlet fever, because, of course, no antibiotics. And Chris, your grandmother wrote about her mother's medicine and how her mother would take care of the kids out there in that log cabin on the farm.
Right. She certainly addresses the day-to-day medicinal needs and the use of home remedies. If you'd like, I'll read a little section.
Sure, yeah.
It says, Mom always used a poultice on sores that needed it. If bread and milk poultice didn't work, guess what? Cow manure poultice. I tell you, it worked. When she greased us for a cold, it was kerosene and lard warmed together till warm and rub it on. It worked, and put 3 drops on a teaspoon of sugar and swallow it to break up a cold.
She also talked about another remedy that would get the toxins out of your system. Tell
right.
me about that one.
It was as the story was told to me, she would occasionally tell one of her children to go out and catch a skunk, and fat skunk, and they would boil it, and the froth from the boiled skunk fat would be mixed with a little bit of kerosene and swallowed, and it would induce instant vomiting.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. That would clean you right out. And I'm surprised at how much kerosene was used in the medicines.
I am too,
household.
And I don't really know the basis of that, but it certainly I don't know if it was just availability, but it was certainly used a lot.
Dorothy, can you give me an idea? Of course, we talked about how isolated these women were on the farm. What kinds of social organizations were beginning to develop during that time among rural women?
Well, there were a number. I guess I first think of the Extension Service, which was really developing. They had the home extension clubs. Now, certainly not all women belong to those. It's the general view is that in immigrant communities, and again in Iowa in the 1920s, you still had these very, very visible and sometimes rather insulated ethnic communities. Generally, if women were of the first or second generation, perhaps they didn't belong to Extension. But on the other hand, many women did. This became increasingly a wonderful way for women to get together. Eventually, in Extension, they would come for the full day. They would bring the youngest children who weren't in school. They would have a lesson in the morning. They would make their noon meal. And then in the afternoon, they would visit. But they always had to get home in time before their children got home from school. There were also township organizations where people got together. The schoolhouse, the rural schoolhouse, was very important. They would have a Christmas program. They would usually have a box social in the spring. But the schoolhouse was often just sort of the center of a rural community. Churches also. And, of course, Iowa had many, many rural churches or churches in the open country during the 1920s and the 1930s.
How did, Catherine, I know that you've done a great deal of study about technology. How did the invention of radio affect these women?
I'm really glad that you asked that question. Dorothy had mentioned, we don't have rural electrification until 1935, but the radio was a piece of equipment that you didn't need highline electricity to run. It could be run on battery power. And Iowa was one of 2 states, I believe New Hampshire was the other, that by the end of the 1920s, more rural people than urban people had radios. And a majority of Iowa farm families had radios. The radio was, much as Dorothy was saying, the telephone was a tool for business. Farm families could get the market reports on the radio. They could get the weather reports on the radio. That was all very important. But in addition to that, it had entertainment programming. There were special programs for the farm homemaker. And Iowa was a real pioneer in setting up farm radio stations that were very oriented toward the farm family. There were programs that instructed farm women in ways to prepare new dishes, in ways to make their household labor more efficient, advice on how to market some of their farm products. And farm youth in particular, you know, the kids who are making up part of the farm labor force, found farm life to be more comfortable, and the theory was they would be less likely to long to leave the farm and go to life in the cities if they could be entertained at home, you know, listening to music or some of the scripted programs. And so once radio is available to Iowa farm families in the 1920s, it becomes one of the most popular pieces of farm household technology because it was seen as a piece of technology that could enhance the life experience of all members of the family. Men, women, and children could all find benefits to listening to the radio.
Well, and we have talked on this program on a number of occasions about the radio homemakers in Iowa,
right,
particularly on KMA radio.
Exactly.
From Shenandoah, the radio homemakers. I've talked to Evelyn Berkby, who was one of the radio homemakers, a little bit later on. But Dorothy, we talked about the isolation of these women, having other women on the air talking about the work that they did and the lives that they led. That must have really helped to alleviate some of that sense of isolation.
Oh, I think it did. I think for many of these women, it was probably the highlight of their day to be able to turn that radio on at a certain time and listen to this woman talking about household problems, giving recipes. I'm sure that farm women came to look upon the radio, the women, radio homemakers. I'm sure they came to look upon them as just old friends. I remember growing up in South Dakota, WNAX Yankton had Lynn Spies, and everyone in South Dakota listened to her, her radio program, and they looked upon her as just someone who they had known for such a long time. So I think that's absolutely right, that that farm women really enjoyed that tremendously. You know, another thing, social activity, and more than social in the countryside, was the beginning of 4-H, that farm children joined 4-H clubs. And it was training for their later work, for the boys later to become farmers, for the girls later to become farm homemakers. But these were wonderful social groups as well. So I think it's fair to say that as time went on, the number of social activities, even in the 20s, really increased for farm people.
And Catherine, from your perspective, what technologies, early technologies, really changed the lives of farm women?
Well, you know, I will, again, note radio, of course. But in terms of the household technology, I think the mechanical washing machine, which again was a piece of equipment that initially you didn't need highline electricity for. You could have a gasoline-powered motor on a washing machine, and the first mechanical washing machines were marketed to farm women because it was understood, you know, the Maytag company and various of the other early washing machine manufacturers, many of which were based right there in Iowa, marketed to farm women because it was understood that farm women had probably larger and dirtier loads of clothing, that they wanted to get their washing done in a very efficient fashion so that they could get on to their other work. There was a famous Maytag ad of this period that said, you know, let Maytag give you more time for your chickens, and had a picture of a woman out feeding her chickens because the laundry was done. So there was a recognition that some of this labor-changing technology in the home could enhance women's role as a farm producer. even though, as I said, the language of the day oftentimes didn't recognize women as farmers or farm producers, but they were. They very much were. And I think some of the early washing machine advertising was very clever in recognizing that.
Even though I can think of other things that I would want more time for than my chickens, but time held a different value back then.
Yes, definitely. And one thing I know Dorothy will agree with me 100% on is that farm women of the 1920s very much valued their role as farm producers and were very proud of that role they played. Again, even though the very language they used didn't always acknowledge that the women, too, were farmers.
And did that kind of farm work that women do, did that provide them, or women did, with maybe the eggs and the chickens mm-hmm. and the kitchen garden, that kind of thing, did that provide them with a little bit of independence and a little bit of income apart from what else was coming in on the farm?
Well, it was largely put back into the service of the family farm, as opposed to the money that women made in their role as producers in their own specific enterprises with the garden and the poultry and whatever. That money was usually, pardon the rural pun, plowed back into the farm family economy, as opposed to women using it, you know, for their own individual purposes. But all of the sociological studies that were being done at this time, particularly out of the University of Wisconsin, showed that the more women had a role in contributing to the family economy, the greater say-so they had in decisions about how some of that farm family money would be used.
And that gave them a little bit more power.
A little bit more, yes.
All right. Well, we are nearly out of time. Catherine Jellison, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Catherine Jellison is professor of history at Ohio University and author of Entitled to Power, Farm Women and Technology, 1913 to 1963. And Dorothy, before I let you go, why do you think it's important that we understand what the lives of women in rural Iowa were like at this time?
Oh, I think it's such a very important part of of Iowa history. It's such a very important part of the history of the United States. You know, agriculture was the dominant industry in the United States for so, so long. And women played such an important role. I was just thinking, as Catherine was talking about the money issue, farm women were so incredibly resourceful. They didn't just have egg money and cream money. They would have people out to the farm. They would serve Sunday dinner to bring in extra money. They would cane chairs. They would have routes in town for their customers in town as a way of making money. Tremendously resourceful.
Well, Dorothy, we are out of time, but thank you so much. Dorothy Schweder is University Professor Emerita of History at Iowa State University. And Chris Baker, thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Baker is author of Others Had It Worse, Sourdough Moonshine, and Hard Times in Davis County, Iowa. He'll be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. We had help today from Jason Burns. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, and Ben Kiefer is here. What's coming up on the show?
Hi, Charity. Coming up at noon, we'll be talking with Representative Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District. We're going to get around to all of our elected officials here in the next couple weeks on River to River. Of course, Syria at the top of the list. We'll find out his views if he can support a military intervention. Also about the digital divide.
Great.
At noon.
Thanks a lot, Ben. River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe.